Welcome to the weekly sermon podcast of Valley Grove Baptist Church. We are thankful you stopped by to hear from God's Word, to grow closer to Him, and to be inspired to reach your area of influence. All right, if you've got your Bibles this morning, let's find 1 Samuel chapter 17. 1 Samuel chapter 17. This morning we will be looking at what quite possibly is one of the most famous stories in the Old Testament. It's probably one we all learned at some point for those of us who spent time in vacation Bible school or in children's Sunday school when we were younger. And if you didn't, that's okay, because you probably know the cliche as it is currently, because our story today is David and Goliath. And so David and Goliath is so well known that people who don't even know the story know what the cliche means. Because anytime someone that's smaller or weaker or lesser defeats someone who is greater and mightier, it is called the story of David and Goliath, right? Whether it be in popular culture, in sports, or in anything, you know, it's oftentimes called a David and Goliath type event. And so today, we're going to look at the real David and Goliath story. Now, I'm going to admit to you, there are a lot of verses. This is one of the longest stories in 1 Samuel. It's well over 50 verses long. So we're not going to read all 50 verses. So as you can tell on the screen, on the TVs, that the first verse we're going to read is in chapter 17, verse 24. So what I'll do is I'll kind of summarize kind of sections on your outline. You'll see I've got a bunch of different sections, and some of them only have like maybe one bullet point or two underneath. And so we'll kind of talk about the sections, and as we go, we'll read some key verses along the way as we make it through. Then we're going to kind of, at the end, after we tell the whole story, we're going to give what I call three overarching, the technical literary term is meta-narrative. Ooh. Which means overarching ideas, and then we're going to take that and pare it down to one singular main idea that applies directly to our life today. All right, we good? All right, let's get to rolling. So, this story takes place right after chapter 16, which we finished last week, which is where David is anointed as the next king over Israel. Now, when I say right after, I don't mean it was the next day. But it is the next big event in the progression of the Samuel narrative in the David story. And so the situation lays out, verses 1 through 3 kind of give us the setting of the story. And the setting is that Israel and the Philistines, that's the same Philistines that Saul has defeated, and they've been defeated, and they've defeated, you know, it's this back and forth kind of battle. Well, there's the two armies are facing each other. The last time we met the Philistines, all the way back in chapter 14, it was in the central, kind of north-central region of Israel. Well, today's battle is way down in the south. And again, the Philistines are trying to control the heights around this vital valley called the Valley of Elah that is a main artery into southern Israel. And so Saul hears about it, and so Saul's forces are on one hill, and the Philistines are on another hill, and the valley is going to be where the battle takes place, okay? Or where the perceived battle is about to happen. All right, so that's kind of the setting. Well, we in verse 4 through 7, an interesting turn of events happens that we have not seen yet in these battle narratives between Israel and their enemies. Instead of describing the armies, plural, the author describes one soldier in great detail, and it's the soldier named Goliath. And so the author goes into great detail about Goliath. Here's some things you need to note. He's 9 feet, 9 inches tall. That's really tall, right? He's 9 feet, 9 inches tall. He has a helmet of bronze. He has bronze leg armors called greaves. He has a coat of mail. That's like chain link mail that is made that weighs 5,000 shekels of bronze. In case you don't know what that converts to in pounds, here you go. It's 126 pounds. So his under armor, not like he would have armor over the top of this most likely, the coat of chain mail that he wears to protect him in battle is 126 pounds by itself. Then it says he carries a javelin of bronze. Now, this is an interesting word, okay? Now, if you have a King James Bible, it may say another word. If you have the translation that we read out of on Sundays that I read, it's the English Standard Version, that's what's on the screens. If you have a Christian Standard Bible or a Holman Standard Bible, it may say sword, okay? There's a lot of variation into what this word means. Some say it's a dart. So when you think of dart, what do you think? Pew, pew. When you think of spear or javelin, what do you think of? Okay? More likely, what the word actually means is sword, a specific type of sword called a scimitar, which is one of those big curved deals, okay? So, and it says he has it slung between his shoulders, all right? So, he has this big curved sword slung between his shoulders, which would make sense because remember, throughout Samuel, we have read that the Philistines controlled the blacksmith forges, and at one point early in the text, it tells us that the Israelite soldiers, none of them had a sword except Saul and Jonathan. The text will later on give us great detail that David has no sword. That's going to be important at the end of the story, right? So it's likely that the word javelin there means a scimitar, a curved sword. All right? So there we go. And then it goes into great detail about the spear that he has. He says it's the shaft of the spear is obviously really big. And then he says the head of the spear weighs 15 pounds. Right? So can you imagine, just go out next time, you know, you're at the gym or anything, get a 15-pound dumbbell and see how far you can throw that sucker. Trust me, you won't get far with it, right? But maybe if you were 9 feet, 9 inches tall, you might could get a little bit further, right? So what do we learn about Goliath? He's a big old fella. He's huge. In fact, I would estimate that his armor alone probably weighs more than David does. Right? He's huge. He is fit for battle. And the text tells us that he is a champion. That means he's not the run-of-the-mill guy in line of battle. He's the best Philistia has to offer, right? And so what does he do? After this description in verses 8 through 10, Goliath offers a challenge. And we haven't seen this yet in Samuel's stories either. This challenge that Goliath offers, it's what's called single combat. So in the ancient world, what might happen in battle is the king or your envoys would come out and say, hey, look, instead of all of us dying out here today, why don't you pick your best soldier and I'll pick my best soldier and them two will fight. And if my guy wins, you'll serve us. And if your guy wins, we'll serve you. And that's how they would fight. Now, sometimes it didn't quite always go that easily, right? You know, as we'll see here. But this is what Goliath is offering. He's offering single combat. All right, hey, I'm a champion. Send me your champion and let's fight. And he does this day after day after day after day. Now, I should have put verse 11 up there. So I know you're in verse, maybe it mentions 24 in your Bible, but find verse 11 because this is key. What does verse 11 say? When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistines, look what it says. They were dismayed and greatly afraid. In other words, the average rank and file soldier among Israel was like, not me. I ain't fighting that guy. And they were greatly afraid. Right? And this goes on. We'll read, and if you read all the verses of the story, you'll see that this goes on for 40 days. They just camped out opposite battles of each other, and Goliath's coming out every day, probably multiple times throughout the day, just in case they forget about him, you know. And for 40 days, Israel is dismayed and greatly afraid. All right, now the story switches in verse 12 through 24. The story switches to David, Because David has not, we know who David is last week, right? He's anointed the next king of Israel. But we don't know what he's doing during this time. Well, verse 12 tells us, David is at home. He's at home with Jesse, his father, tending to their sheep, and he's just doing his normal everyday things that he should be doing as the youngest son. He's taking care of all the chores and all that. Well, Jesse is obviously worried about his sons because they've been gone for 40 days. So he sends David with some food for them and for their commander, and he says, David, go check on your brothers and bring me back a report about how they're doing, right? So David does what he ought to do. He is obedient to his father, and he heads off to the battlefield, right? And so as he gets to the battlefield, he hears the commotion of battle, right? He hears the beats of the drums or the clamoring of metal and, you know, all this. And so I can imagine you put yourself in there. Your brothers are off at this battle, and he will probably wants to know what's going on. So the text tells us, I love how the Bible kind of inserts these little bitty little things that, you know, you wouldn't normally think about. And it makes you, puts you into the story. And one of them is, it says he leaves the food with the keeper of the luggage. And I imagine this is like that he kind of like, hey, bud, hey, phew, here you go. It's for my brothers. There you go. Keep him. And he runs off. Why? Because he hears all this commotion. And just as David gets there, Goliath shows up for his daily, you bunch of wimps, come fight me. Right? And then verse 24 happens. So David's there on the scene. He hears Goliath. He hears all the sounds of battle. He hears the disparaging remarks that Goliath makes. And then he sees this right here. All the men of Israel, including his own brothers, when they saw the man, that's Goliath, they fled from him and were much afraid. So David gets up there, sees this Goliath guy saying all these nasty things about the God of Israel, about their soldiers, and then sees his own brothers and the entire army fled from him, for they were much afraid. All right? So then we turn to verse 25 and following. So David begins to speak with the soldiers, and he's asking what's going on. And so in verse 25, it tells us that, and the men of Israel said, have you seen this man who has come up? No, he ain't seen him. He ain't been there, except for just now. Surely he has come up to defy Israel, and the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches and will give him his daughter in marriage and make his father's house free in Israel. Anyway, what he's meaning is, hey, whoever kills this guy don't have to pay no more taxes. And he'll get a wife and he'll be rich. All right. Verse 26. And David said to the men who stood by him, I love this. What shall be done for the man who kills the Philistines and takes away the reproach of Israel? I love this line right here. I love this line. You ready? 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 For who is this uncircumcised Philistine? Ah! That he should defy the armies of the living God. Like, who's this guy think he is? Some uncircumcised Philistine. Like, that's the best insult David could come up with at the moment, right? Right, that's the best he's got at the moment. You uncircumcised Philistine. Who are you? All right, so David gets there, speaks to the soldiers. They keep talking. Now, verse 28 lets you know that the Bible understands family interpersonal relationships. You want to know why? Because David has done found his oldest brother, Eliab. And Eliab pulls the older brother card with the younger brother. And in essence says, what are you doing here? You ought to be home. Shut up. You don't know what you're talking about. We've been here for 40 days. What are dad's sheep doing around? What are they doing now that you're up here? And David's like, I'm just doing what I was told to do. Right? That's, you know, older brothers. Y'all do that. We all did that. Younger brothers. You've been there before, right? Anybody the younger brother? Anybody? Somebody? Maybe? Yeah. And guess what happened? You reacted the same way. Like, oh, well, what was I doing? Right? So Eliab pulls the older brother card on David. But notice, David is undeterred by his older brother. And the text tells us he goes right back to talking to the soldiers about this uncircumcised Philistine. Right? He does not let Eliab shake him from what he is trying to do. And in verse 31 through 40, David speaks boldly. He says, "Let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go out and fight this Philistine." In fact, David's words reach Saul. They reach Saul, the king. Right? Now, David knows Saul because David's been what? Playing the harp for Saul when the evil spirit came on him that tormented him. Right? So Saul finds David's, hears David's words, and they bring David in, and he repeats these words to Saul. "Let no man's heart fail because of him. Yours, me, I will go fight this Philistine." But Saul objects and says, "David, you can't go. You're too young." Now, why is David too young? Well, the reason he's too young and the reason he's not at the battle already is because he's not old enough to be in the army yet. Numbers, got it right here if you want to look at it. Numbers 1, 3, and 26, 2 tell us that you at least had to be 20 years old to be in the army in Israel. So what does that mean? What can we understand about David's age? He is a teenager. Yes, David is at no older than 19. He is a teenager. And this teenager says, "Hey, don't worry about it. I'll go fight the Philistine." And Saul says, "No, you ain't. You a teenager." And then David recounts at least two experiences how God showed up and used him to defeat his enemies. And so David says that, "And when there came a lion and a bear and took one of the lambs from the flock," listen to this, "I went after him." No, hold on. So get the image. The bear comes, takes the lamb, and runs off. David says, "Oh, I didn't let him run off. I ran after that animal." He intentionally ran after the bear and the lion. All right, let's keep going. "I went after him and struck him and delivered it," the sheep or the lamb, "out of his mouth." Now listen to this last part. Lest you think David was a wimp. "And if he," the bear or lion, "arose against me, I caught him by the beard and struck him and killed him." Do we get what's going on here? David is out here fighting hand-to-hand combat, bears and lions. Whoa. I literally wrote in my notes, "Wow," all caps, exclamation point. Right? Because many of us think we're tough. But I can guarantee you, if a lion or a bear showed up, we are running. I'm not trying to kill it with my pocket knife. All right? Get me out of here, Lord. But David goes after it, runs after it, grabs it by the beard, by the chin hairs, and whoo, that's impressive. And he's basically tells Saul, "If God can save me from that, he can help me kill this Philistine too." And so, and also, what kind of between the lines, what can we realize about David's mindset on Goliath? He's not only an uncircumcised Philistine, he ain't no different than an animal. He is an uncircumcised Philistine animal. And if God helped me, deliver me from them, he'll deliver me from this one as well. Right? So, after that, Saul is like, okay, go for it. And Saul tries to give David his armor, but David doesn't wear it. And instead, David grabs what he knows, what he has tested out, which he takes 5 smooth stones. One author said they might be as big as a tennis ball. So like this size. He grabs those and puts them in a sling. And now when we think of slingshot, we think of, you know, the stick that's shaped like a Y and you pull back like that. This was how it had a pouch in the middle, and it was 2 long strings, and they would whip it around their head, and phew. And it was, this was actually a battle unit, an army unit in battle that would be used in the ancient world, were slingers. It was a well-known counter unit for certain types of soldiers, and so that was David's weapon of choice. And so David goes out to meet Goliath in verses 41 through 53. It's kind of the battle scene. And Goliath mocks and scoffs at such a minuscule candidate. He even says, are you coming at me as if I am a dog with sticks? Again, that's a slander toward David. Like, what are you doing? What does this guy think he's going to do? But David does not let the mocking and scoffing go unchecked. In verses 45 through 47, here's what David says. Speaking to Goliath directly. You come at me. And remember, David didn't go, you come at me. David is probably yelling. Why? Because remember, they're coming down the mountain or the hills into the valley, and they're across from each other. And so David is yelling. So this isn't just a message for Goliath. It's also a message for all those guys behind him who have fled in dismay and fear the entire 40 days, right? And so what does David say? You come to me with a sword and with a spear and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. Then he says, this day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. Now listen, how's David going to cut off his head? He ain't got no sword. All right, well, we'll find out. And I will, oh man, David, boy, he's a dude now. And I will give the dead bodies of the host of the Philistines this day to the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the earth. And listen, whenever you're reading your Bible, and whenever you come across a that or a so that, you are about to read a statement of purpose. So David is saying, God is going to deliver you into my hands today. That, number one, all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. That everybody, from the Philistines to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field, that they will, one, know that there is a God in Israel. And that, second purpose, all this assembly, both you and us, may know the Lord saves, not with spears and not with swords. For the battle is the Lord's, and He will give you into our hand. In other words, God is going to defeat you today so that everybody knows that He is God, and so that this assembly knows that God is the one who saves, not military might and military power and champions of the army, right? And so David has just thrown it down and said, hey, this is it. The story goes on and says that Goliath moves out toward David. Like, he is walking toward David. Remember, he is heavily armored, right? And he is thinking that this is going to be hand-to-hand combat. And I love this. It says that Goliath walks out toward David, but the text tells us that David runs. David is not playing a defensive battle. This is not a war of attrition. No, sir. David runs to meet Goliath with his sling, and the text tells us that he shoots his shot, so to speak. He throws this rock with his sling at Goliath, and lo and behold, David only needs one shot because the rock finds its mark. the text tells us that it hits Goliath square in the forehead, and that the stone sunk deep in his skull. It basically hit right here and crushed all of this so that he had a deep indention, and immediately Goliath falls dead. Now, since David is running, in my mind, the way I see this playing out, and in my imagination as I read the text, is that David is running. I'm not going to run, but David's running, and he throws and he keeps running, right? He don't stop running, and Goliath is dead. He falls down, and then remember, David said, hey, you know, you cut your head off today. Well, whose sword does he use? He ain't got a sword. He grabs Goliath's giant-sized sword, that curved scimitar thing, and lops Goliath's head off and holds the sucker up. And then all the Philistine armies are like, oh no, we're in trouble. And they start running. And then all the Israelites are out there watching, like, probably going, they realize that the Philistines are running. And so David then proceeds to lead them in battle, and they absolutely rout the Philistines. And they defeat them, and the story tells us they defeat them all to these cities and push them basically out of the southern region back into what is their home territory. Pushes them all out of Judah and southern Israel at that point. And they win because of David's great heroism. They win this great battle against the Philistines. Now, the story ends with David and Saul talking again. And it kind of, the text appears to lead us to believe that Saul didn't enter into the battle, but he hears about it and he wants to go, he wants to hear what happened. And so his general finds David, and David walks in. He's still got that head in his hands, right? He got Goliath's giant noggin in his head, just carrying it around, and he brings it into Saul, which I guess that's what you did back then, right? It's kind of gross to me. But here, David presents the head, and they have this conversation, Saul and David. And he's like, hey, David, who's your father? Why would he ask him that? Well, remember, the guy who defeated the Goliath, his father didn't have to what? Pay taxes anymore, right? So he's like, hey, who's your dad? And then the text, which will set us up for next week, says to David, hey, bud, you've done this great service. You need to just stay here with me permanently. And it says from that day forward, David stayed with Saul, and he did not go back to his father's house. So we have this great battle scene, right? And so to me, there are three overarching stories, or three overarching meta-narrative points that this story tries to make. Or this story not tries, but does make. Number one, you have to see the differentiation between Saul and Israel and David. Saul and Israel, the text tells us twice, what do they do? They are dismayed and greatly afraid. Verse 11, and in verse 24, they flee when they see the man. They are terrified for 40 days. Every day they live in terror and fear and dismay and are trying to figure out, what are we going to do with this Goliath guy? Because ain't none of us man enough to go out and fight him. Saul ain't. None of the soldiers are. Nobody wants to... Why do you think Saul has to say, hey, whoever beats this man, I'll be rich, and then I'll give you my daughter. And oh, by the way, your dad and family don't have to pay taxes anymore. He has to say that because on day one, nobody offers to fight him. Right? So it's like, it's just to up the ante until maybe somebody will try. Nobody does. But David, a teenager, not a soldier, not a warrior, not a champion, a shepherd boy, the youngest in his family. The first day, it doesn't even take him a day. The first hours he shows up on the scene, what does he say? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine? Who is he against our God? And then he says, hey, I don't know about y'all. I don't know what y'all gonna do. I will go take care of this guy. And then Saul tries to go, oh, no. You're too young. And David goes, not all, you don't understand. God has saved me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear. And even when they attacked me, I grabbed them by the chin hairs and killed them. And God's going to do the same thing for this guy. And so you cannot help but read the story and see that this group over here lives in fear and David lives in confidence because he knows who God is and because he has experienced God's saving power. Now, this group has experienced it over here. Just in chapter 15, even though Saul is disobedient in the end, God gives Israel great victory over the Amalekites. And earlier, God gave them great victory over the Philistines in the north central region. And earlier than that, God gave them great victory over the Ammonites across the River Jordan. And before that, their forefathers had great victories through Joshua and through Moses. And the founder of the Israelite people, Abraham, had great victories. But this group completely forgets all about that. And so kind of the underlying point is when we forget what God has done for us in the past, it makes us have fear in the future. But when we live in, we remember what God has done for us in the past, it gives us confidence in the future. That's kind of an underlying idea. That's not on your outline anymore. That's free. There you go. All right. Now, overarching point number two. Okay, overarching point number two that you have to admit is the irony of the battle. On this hand, you have Goliath, an absolute dude. I mean, he is 9 foot, 9 inches tall, right? A trained soldier. His armor and armaments probably weigh more than David. He is an absolute champion in single combat battle against a shepherd boy with no armor, with no training, and just a sling. Like, I mean, let's be honest. If Vegas is putting odds on this, the odds are heavily in favor of Goliath. Nobody is taking David in this fight, right? Because it is an unfair battle, at least from worldly perspectives. But what happens? Goliath doesn't win. David wins. Now you can say, how does that happen? Well, that's the third overarching point, is that God shows up. Now, I say it that way not to indicate that God was absent or on vacation the first 40 days. That's not true. God was there. They just forgot about him. Right? That's why they lived in fear and were dismayed and ran away when they saw him. They forgot about the Lord. David comes on the scene remembering the Lord, and God shows up because he works through David. God is working through David, and God shows up on the scene, and the text is absolutely clear that yes, it is through David's actions that God's work, but it is absolutely God's hand that kills Goliath. Think about the story. Now, I may be trying to make a little more hay here than I'm just going to just lay this out front, so just take this with a grain of salt. But in my mind, as I'm reading this story and I'm thinking through these events, there's one key detail that's fascinating to me. And it's the part of the story where it tells us that when David threw the rock and slung the rock in the sling, I guess that's how you would say it. When he slung the rock, is that that actual word? Am I making it? Y'all, it'll be okay. All right. David slung the rock. The text tells us that it hit Goliath in the forehead and went deep. Okay? So, in my mind, untrained physics mind, if the Goliath is walking toward David and Goliath is running and slings the rock and it goes deep in his forehead, the natural trajectory of Goliath's body in my mind should be which way? Backwards. He's tall, right? He hit him way up here. In my mind, he's going to go backwards. Now, I could be wrong, but the text is very clear. The editors of the text don't have to put this part of this in the story. They don't have to tell us that Goliath fell forward, but they do. Because he's already dead when he hits the ground, and he's really dead when David cuts his head off. And whether he falls backward or forward, David is going to run up there and cut his head off anyway. But the text explicitly takes a few words to tell us that Goliath fell forward. Now, how does he get hit with a rock this way but fall forward? In my mind, that is the Lord's hand absolutely doing what David said he would do, making it unequivocally clear that this was God's battle. The battle, David said, for the battle is the Lord's, and this is a tangible way for God to show everybody there, Philistine and Israelite, David and Saul, everybody, that God saves his people from their enemies. Because when David slings the rock, Goliath falls forward, stone cold dead, and then David keeps on running and cuts his head off. God shows up in the midst of the battle with the giant, right? So three overarching ideas. You've got a difference in attitude between Saul and the army and David. You've got the irony of the battle. You've got a trained giant soldier, champion, an untrained shepherd boy with rocks and a sling. And then you've got this idea that God shows up in the midst of all of this. So what's the one idea that we can take home? And it's really simple. It's one, and I know we may be sounding like we're beating a dead horse, but this is the point that the author of Samuel is trying to show us, is that God shows up. God defeats the giants in our life. God defeats the giants in our life. God opposes the people. You can say it this way. God actively opposes the enemies of his people, right? God opposes the enemies of his people. God defeats the enemies of his people. God defeats the giants in your life. That's the main idea of this story. And we see that played out over and over and over again in the Old Testament, right? Joshua in the Battle of Jericho, a couple centuries beforehand. Joshua in the Battle of Jericho, an imposing city. And what does God do? Makes him walls come a-tumbling down, as the song says, right? And over and over and over again. There's another story that happens hundreds of years later than this story, where the army of Jehoshaphat is up against this other opposing army, and God brings this miraculous battle. In the Old Testament, in Numbers, I believe it is, with the Amalekites, we talked about this a couple weeks ago, God makes the sun stand still so his people can win the battle. Over and over and over and over again in the Old Testament, God defeats those giants who oppose his people. But the greatest clarity that we see in the text of Scripture of God defeating giants is in the New Testament. And it comes in the work of the person of Jesus Christ. Because Jesus defeats the one giant that you and I could never defeat. Jesus defeats sin, death, hell, and the grave. I was reading this morning in Hebrews again, chapter 10, talking about how Jesus is our great high priest because he gave up his own blood, shed his own blood so that our sins might be covered and might be cleansed because we couldn't deal with our own sin, our own giant in our own life, in our own heart, and in our own mind. We were helpless and hopeless to defeat, right? The text tells us we might be good moral people, but we're not on the road to heaven. We might make good decisions sometimes, and we might be a good friend and a good neighbor, but the text tells us, the scriptures tell us, the New Testament tells us that we have a deep problem rooted in our heart, and it's called sin. We are all born with a sin nature, and the only way that we can overcome sin in our life is if we accept the sacrifice that Jesus gave for us. Jesus says in John 14:6, he says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father except through me." We can try in our own power. We can try in our own ideas. We can try other religions. But Jesus says the only way for you and I to have life, to have healing, to have hope, to have forgiveness of sins is if we have given our life to Him, if we have believed in the sacrifice that He gave for us. The greatest giant in our life is not enemies in foreign worlds. It is not domestic terrorists. It is not politicians of a different party than what we vote for. It is not Islamic terrorists. It's not the communists. The greatest enemy we have lives inside of us, and it is the sin nature that we are born with. And unless, listen to me, unless we ask Jesus to do something about that, nothing will ever be done about it, because we are hopeless and helpless to get rid of it and to overcome it. We must have Jesus defeat the Goliath of sin in our hearts and lives. And so here's the question that I'm going to ask you today. Have you ever done that? I'm sure you've tried hard. I know I did. But my life changed as a 15-year-old, 14-year-old, somewhere around there, when I stopped trying on my own and I said, in a cold, wintry, brown February hall room in West Virginia on a ski retreat, when I finally said, hey, Lord, I need You to help me with this sin thing because I keep messing it up. I need You to forgive me of all my sins. I'm accepting Jesus' sacrifice for my life. So here's the question. Have you done that today? I hope you have. If you haven't, Mr. Ernie's about to come up. Ms. Ruby's about to come up. We're going to have a hymn of invitation, of response. And my ask of you is that if you've never done that, do it today. Don't leave this place without asking Jesus to defeat the greatest giant in your own life, and that's your own sin. Trust me, He will do it, and it will be the greatest, greatest decision you will ever make, because Jesus will change your life for the better.
Thanks for listening. For more information about Valley Grove, visit our Facebook page or website, valleygrovechurch.org.